Daniel, Chapter 7, the ninth talk in a series on Daniel, was presented by David Crabtree on June 14, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 9, Daniel, Chapter 7, accompanies this talk.
Welcome, everybody. This is our online version of Reformation Fellowship. Thank you all for coming. We'll be looking at Daniel chapter 7 in our ongoing series. But first, I got a question from Denise. I'll read the question and then respond to it. I'm going to use this as an opportunity to give just a little bit of a review of what I've been saying that Daniel is about. So this question should be good. My question is, how might the empire of socialism differ from the empire of democracy or a democratic republic? Now, if you've been following along, you know that what I've been arguing is that Daniel is about empire. And the way that I'm using the word empire, it is looking back at the ancient construction where institution, where one kingdom would conquer other nations and try to incorporate them all, use all of the resources from those other countries and focus them towards one goal. And that one goal was for the wealth and prosperity and security of the dominant kingdom. And so the way I'm defining empires is any time that you have people coming together and working cooperatively to provide for their own security and safety and prosperity with the understanding that everyone grant to that entity, to that community, that cooperative, their highest allegiance. And I'm getting this based on things that I've learned in Genesis. So the first 11 chapters of Genesis are developing this notion of the sinful nature of man. And that section culminates with the Tower of Babel, which is one of these cooperative efforts to take care of their own security and prosperity by working together, combining their efforts, and granting to that entity their allegiance in exchange. And the way that I'm getting that, the reason that I think that Daniel is building on that concept is because the book of Daniel begins with a reference to Shinar, which harkens back to those early chapters of Genesis, that geographical name that was used. Furthermore, although our English Bibles translate the tower, talk about the Tower of Babel, that word is Bavel, and that's the same word that is used throughout the Old Testament for Babylon. So there's a huge amount of continuity there. And furthermore, the same concept is picked up and built on in the book of Revelation, where it talks about Babylon. So I think this is a concept that carries throughout, and Daniel is helping us to understand what the Bible means when it talks about empire and the key representative of that class of institutions is Babylon. Now, to answer Denise's question, wherever there are people, there is a tendency to build empire, it seems to me. It's a huge tendency that's built into us as sinners. It is not unique to any particular form of government. However, having said that, There are some forms of government that are more resistant to empire building than are others. Socialism, in order to build empire, there is the best way, the most convenient way to do that is to have centralized administration. If you have centralized administration, it's a lot easier to exercise control over what people do and how resources are used. Socialism is highly centralized. It is the whole notion of socialism that it would be highly centralized. And therefore, socialism offers very little resistance to the building of empire. A representative democracy is designed to be decentralized. It's an attempt to distribute power into lots of different places and make it difficult for that power to be centralized. Our government in particular was made to be inefficient, and boy, did they succeed. It was made to be inefficient and not get much done. And that was really part of the thinking of the founding fathers. That makes it more resistant to empire. However, people are clever. People are smart beings and can find a way around anything. So a representative democracy there's no question. A democratic republic can definitely be converted into an empire without difficulty. It just seems to me that empire can develop out of any governmental form because human beings are desperate for something to alleviate our fears and insecurities. That's the basis on which empire is built. And unfortunately, we will strike a devil's bargain to be safe and secure. And that's what makes empire possible. Okay. Looking at the chapter 7. This is, as I've mentioned before, there is a major change in the text that takes place when we enter into chapter 7. It's immediately obvious. It's a different genre. It's a different kind of thing. The first half of the book was historical narrative, and there were visions in the first half of the book, but those visions came to kings, and Daniel then interpreted those visions as part of the narrative. Events throughout the first half were given in chronological order. In the second half of the book, we go back in time about 13 years. The vision that we'll look at tonight in chapter 7, it occurred 13 years before the events of chapter 6. In chapter 7, we have visions again, but this time they are visions that come to Daniel, and Daniel records those visions. And so this last half is just a report of those visions that Daniel had. Those visions, though, will be given in chronological order. So now we're going back in time, but from now on, we will go in chronological order again, like happened in the first half of the book. So this chapter is a transitional chapter. In some ways, it's related to the first half of the book, and in some ways, it's related to the second half of the book. And I will point out, as I've mentioned before, half of the book is written in Hebrew, and half of it is written in Aramaic. The first chapter was in Hebrew. Then it switched at the beginning of chapter 2, early in chapter 2. It switched into Aramaic, and it is in Aramaic until the end of chapter 7. Then it's going to switch back into Hebrew for the rest of the book. And what I've argued is when it's in Aramaic, the primary audience, I'm emphasizing primary because it's not the sole audience, but the primary audience, I think, is the world, it's the Gentiles. In the last half, it's more narrowly focused and more directed towards the people of Israel. But chapter 7 is transitional. In some ways, it's summing up all that we've seen in the first half of Daniel, And in other ways, it's kind of an introduction to the last part of Daniel. We're going to see a series of visions in this last part of Daniel. And the visions are very difficult to interpret. There are lots of interpretations that have been offered for each of these visions. This last summer, I watched a lot of YouTube videos of teaching on, in particular, chapter 7, but some of the other visions as well. And there are lots of different ideas about how they should be put together. They're difficult. I will point out that most scholars think that these visions were written after the death of Antiochus Epiphanes in 164 BC. The reason they put it at that date is they think that all of the predictions that are made in these visions, that they are what they call pseudo-predictions, pseudo-prophecy. That is to say, they are predicting things that have already happened. They're pretending to predict things that have already happened. And that's the way that scholars think that there was so much accuracy and precision in the predictions that were made. I am not assuming that. I'm assuming that it was written around 500 BC, so around the time of Daniel. It may not have been written by Daniel himself. I don't know. It could have been written by people that were familiar with Daniel, heard him teach or talk or whatever, and took the notes that he had written down and wrote up an account after Daniel had died. I don't know. That's possible. I don't see any reason that could not have happened. But I'm assuming that these were written either by Daniel or soon after the time that Daniel lived, and that the prophecies are indeed prophecies rather than pseudo-prophecies, that they are indeed predicting the events, and then the events unfold accordingly. I mentioned in my introduction that there are tons of assumptions that go into my interpretation of Daniel. It's unavoidable. You've got to make assumptions, otherwise you're stuck with just a gazillion different possibilities. And so to narrow it down and make any progress, you have to start saying, well, I can't prove that this is the case, but I'm going to assume that I think I have good reason to proceed as though this is the case, and I will assume that it's the case. So there are tons of assumptions that go behind my interpretation. And at first I was thinking, well, I'll just lay all the assumptions out. And then I thought, my goodness, that as I started to do that, it got too tedious and was not going to be workable. So for the most part, I haven't laid out all of my assumptions. Sometimes I have, and I told you that I would. I'm going to list three assumptions that are significant in the way that I look at the prophecies and the visions here in Daniel, and just so that you know what they are. Because if those assumptions are false, then that calls into question my interpretation. The first one is that all details are significant. Every detail that's in these visions is there for a reason. And we may not be able to identify the reason, but it's worth looking for a reason. And I'm assuming that there is a reason for it. If I can't find it, then that's just something left hanging. I can't explain, but it does ultimately require explanation. Those details then go towards helping us to identify the meanings of the various symbols. My second assumption is that the visions in Daniel are all related. When I first started looking at Daniel, I was not at all convinced of this. It looked to me like the different visions were so different that they each had their own topic and they were doing very different things. But over time, I've convinced myself that, in fact, the visions do seem to be hammering on the same theme. they look at it from different angles. They are making different points with respect to that theme, but they're all developing the same theme or themes. And right at the heart of that is, what is the nature of empire? I'm going to use that assumption as I look at chapter 7, because I think there's a great deal of overlap between chapter 2, the vision of the statue made of different metals, and this vision in chapter 7. So if this assumption is wrong, it calls into question my interpretation. The third one is, it seems to me, having read a lot of prophecy over the last few years, looked at a lot of the prophetic works over the last few years, even though I don't understand everything that's in those books by a long shot, it does appear to me that all of the prophets are ultimately talking about the end. And in their prophecies, they are ultimately talking about the end. It seems to me that from the prophetic perspective, the end, what happens in the end, is absolutely critical to understand. And most importantly, that God, all of his promises, and all of his people are vindicated in the end. And it's extremely important that we understand that that is true. That is going to happen for sure. Oftentimes in the prophetic works, it will talk about events in the shorter term and sometimes make prophetic predictions with respect to events in the shorter term. But its main interest is in the fact that those shorter term events bear some likeness to a relationship to the end of history. So in some sense or another, all of prophecy seems to be trying to clarify, what is the end? How do things finish up? And then just one comment that I will make, I couldn't figure out where best to incorporate this in, but just the observation. I'm not sure what to do with this observation, but the observation that when we start out in the second half of the book, the visions are highly symbolic. Chapter 7, this vision is highly symbolic. As we get to chapter 8, it starts out highly symbolic, and then by the end of this vision, it's not nearly as symbolic. And as we get to the vision in chapters 10 and 11, it's not symbolic at all. So the symbolism drops off, and literal prophetic claims, predictive claims, replace those as we get towards the end. I'm not sure why that is, but I think it's an interesting observation. Okay, that's my introduction to chapter 7 and to the second half of Daniel. Daniel 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. So we know when this happens. It's the first year of Belshazzar. That's the year 551. Now, just refreshing our memory about Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the king of Babylon. He became the king of Babylon in 551. He was the last king of Babylon, but he wasn't ever fully king of the Babylonian Empire. That is because 3 years before he became king of Babylon, he was involved in a coup along with some of his friends, and he was young at the time and his friends were young at the time, that they were the ones who organized a coup to get rid of the king of Babylon that was reigning at the time. And that was the son of another king. And he had only been reigning for a few months when Belshazzar and his young friends decided to get rid of him. For reasons that I can't find, apparently historians don't know, for reasons that are unknown, Belshazzar led this coup, but Belshazzar did not become the king of Babylon at that time. Rather, his father, Nabonidus, became king of Babylon. So Belshazzar and his friends organize this coup, and they depose, they get rid of the previous king, but Nabonidus steps in and becomes king. Not clear why, but that's what happened. Nabonidus is king for about 3 years, and then Nabonidus, for reasons that are not clear, again, he takes off. He leaves Babylon, the city of Babylon, and he goes to Tema, which is in present-day Saudi Arabia, near where Mecca and Medina are currently located. He went there, and it's not clear whether that was part of the Babylonian Empire when he went there, or whether he went there in order to conquer that area, or it could have been that he just went there to gain more control over that area for Babylon. In any case, that's where he went. That's what he did. And so for 13 years, he was in Tema. That's where he lived. That's the place from which he ruled. However, he didn't come back to Babylon that whole time. His son reigned in Babylon in his absence, and apparently his son had control of the whole Mesopotamian Valley. So the city of Babylon and then the surrounding areas for quite a ways. So he was essentially the king of Babylon, but he was not officially the king of Babylon. It is clear from the historical record that he was a very self-serving ruler. As soon as he came in, he started siphoning off resources for himself and for his young friends. And then furthermore, we see in chapter 5, he was the one who was the king when God reached down and wrote on the wall. And Daniel came and interpreted that. And we see in that scene, Belshazzar ordering that the utensils from Yahweh's temple in Jerusalem that had been taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, that those be brought into the feasting hall, and Belshazzar drank from those vessels, mocking the God of Judah, mocking Yahweh. So this vision, this first vision that Daniel receives, was received at a time when he is now seeing the first emperor in Babylon who has the potential for making that empire truly evil. He was probably the most self-serving emperor that Babylon had. Daniel has this dream while he slept, but after he has the dream, he writes a summary. So we know that there's a written record that was made of this dream and what happened in it. Presumably then, that's what he did with the other visions as well. So presumably, Daniel left notes of all of these visions and maybe some other things that could have been incorporated into the book of Daniel, either by him or someone else. Okay, the rest of the chapter 7 now is going to go through and talk about that vision and talk about an interpretation of that vision that was given to him within the vision. So I'm going to go through that. It's a little bit, it could be a bit repetitive. So I'm going to go through it and try to keep the repetition to a minimum. So I'm going to go through and comment on the vision itself, just make some comments on the vision itself. Then I'll talk about the interpretation and make some comments on that. Then after we've gone through the whole chapter, I'll try to pull it together into a coherent whole as best I can. Daniel 7, verses 2-8. Daniel said, In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, "Get up and eat your fill of flesh." After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully. So Daniel was lying in his bed when this vision came to him, asleep at night, apparently. It says the 4 winds of heaven. Now the Aramaic word, this is in Aramaic, but the Aramaic word and the closely related Hebrew word, and I should point out these are closely related languages. So the vocabulary, there's a lot of similarity in vocabulary from Hebrew to Aramaic. And this is one of those words that is the same in both languages. That word can mean either wind or spirit. It was often used in the Old Testament to refer to the activity of God. In the creation account, in chapter 1 of Genesis, it talks about the earth being formless and void and dark. Darkness was over the sea. And then it says that the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. And the Spirit of God there is this word, Ruach. So that word is frequently used to talk about God's activity. And in Genesis 1, that Spirit hovering is a great image of God poised to act, to do something, to take care of this chaotic scene and bring order to it. So the 4 winds of heaven, I think, is reference to God's divine activity. And the winds of heaven seems to underscore the fact that that's referring to God. The number four, I think, is used to suggest all or the full complement. I've talked about this before. It's a strange phenomenon in Hebrew where there are several words that you see commentators say it means all. But what it took me for a long time to figure this out, but these words seem to symbolize all, but they have different connotations. The word seven seems to refer to all or the full complement. But it is used in contexts where what it's being talked about are holy things. So it's the full complement of holy things. 4 is likewise means all or the full complement, but it seems to have the connotation of things with respect to this world, things in this world. So in my notes, I have worldly, but I don't mean in the sense of sinful necessarily, just of this world. So the 4 winds then would mean the full complement of God's activity acting in the world. Then this the great sea. The great sea is a common image, the sea, There's a great common in create a common image in the ancient Near East. And to understand this image, you have to understand the perspective of the ancient Near East, the worldview. Their perspective was that the natural state of things is chaos. And chaos is when things are just not, things don't work, things are bad. Chaos is like natural disaster. It's like bugs that come in and eat the crops completely. There's no harvest left. It's like earthquakes. It's like windstorms. It's like floods. It's like any time when the natural state of things encroaches on the order that we need in order to live our lives. So that's the chaos. And from their perspective, the only thing that could keep chaos from crashing in on us is the gods. It was the gods' job to hold that chaos back. And if they didn't do that, we'd be swamped by chaos and everyone would die. So worship of the gods was calling on them to hold the chaos back. So worship of the gods was critical for their survival. So in the iconography of the ancient Near East, you see images, and this is in their poetry as well, images of the gods fighting chaos. In German scholarship, the word they use is Chaoskampf, so fighting against chaos. And the sea was understood to be the place from which chaos came. So the sea is like this pool of all kinds of chaotic forces. And if they ever come out, and usually it's sea creatures, if they ever emerge at all, then they are agents of chaos. They bring chaos wherever they go. Now, I said in my notes to notice that in our account, the sea is not named. It's just a symbol. But I looked at that, and that's not true. The word that's used there, the term that's used there, is the term that's usually used for the Mediterranean Sea. But nevertheless, I think this reference to the sea is a reference to this pool of forces of chaos. That would be very much in keeping with the ancient Near Eastern imagery. And we have the Old Testament using that imagery elsewhere. The creation story was written as an account of God bringing order to the chaos. But it's interesting that the creation account is described in terms of God slowly bringing order to a chaotic situation. And I think that's intentional, drawing upon the worldview and understanding of the ancient Near East. And in the Old Testament, chaos is equated with the forces that are hostile to God. So, for instance, in Isaiah 51:9, it talks about God fighting Rahab, and Rahab is a sea creature. So God fought Rahab when he brought the people of Israel out of Egypt. So it's likening God's redemption, God bringing the people of Israel out of Egypt. It's likening that to this fight against chaos. And there are other times, Psalm 74:12 through 14, where God is pictured as one who's fighting against the sea creatures, the creatures coming out of the sea. The next term is the four great beasts. So we have these beasts, and they come out of the sea. So they are creatures that are born of the sea. They aren't sea creatures, but they are born of the sea. And it points out that they are all different one from another. It is not clear from the texts that we've read so far, that whether they're all coming out and marching around on the ground, on the dry earth at the same time, or the one comes out and marches around for a while, and then a different one comes out and replaces that first one. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. Now the beasts, the first beast, it's like a lion with eagle's wings. This is a common motif in the ancient Near East of a lion with wings, oftentimes eagle's wings. That's not the only, there can be bulls with eagle's wings as well, but lions with eagle's wings is common. And it is one of the decorations on the walls of the city of Babylon that were unearthed. And we've talked about this before. They are now in a museum in Berlin. And the Gate of Ishtar in particular is in the museum in Berlin. And this has lions and bulls and bears on it. But in that particular case, none of those beasts have wings. But we do have iconography where with lions with wings. This first beast is what is called in German scholarship a Mischwesen. The Germans have a technical term for everything. They're wonderful at coming up with those. A Mischwesen, a mixed essence, a mixed being. So all of these are mixed animals. And that was a very common device in the ancient Near East. Oftentimes it's an animal that usually does not have wings, that wings are stuck onto. Sometimes it'll be a common animal with a human head stuck on it. There are various combinations that were used. Generally speaking, they were believed to be powerful and fearsome. They were unnatural. Those mixed animals, they didn't occur naturally, so there's something spooky about it right from the get-go. And perhaps believed to be supernatural. And these mixed animals were often found guarding a king's throne or at the entrance of a king's palace. So they are like guardian creatures, fierce guardian creatures. So each of these beasts that we look at least the first three, they are all these Mischwesen, these mixed animals. This first one, the lion with wings, is transformed in the vision. The wings are removed, and what we have left is this lion, but this lion becomes a bit manlike. It is caused to stand on its hind feet like a man. So rather than on its four feet, it's on its hind feet. And it's given the mind or the heart of a man. So in two respects, it's transformed within the vision itself to be man-like. The second beast is a bear. It's like a bear. Notice that all of these are like something. It doesn't say that it's a bear. It doesn't say that it's anything. It says it's like a bear. Oh, this one is not a Mischwesen. I'd forgotten that. This one is not. We have a bear or something that looks like a bear. And it's hard to tell from the description exactly what it's saying about it, but it's lopsided somehow. It seems to be one side of it is more developed than the other. It's not real clear. And it has three ribs sticking out of its mouth as if it's just eaten something and is just savoring the last few bones. Why three? Well, we'll talk about that. And then within the vision, there's a voice that says, "Arise, eat much meat." We'll come back to that. The third beast, it is like a leopard, but it has four wings. So it's a Mischwesen. But this is unlike a leopard in that it also has four heads. So four heads four wings. And then the text says that it is given authority to rule. Then we come to the fourth beast. And this is clearly the most attention-getting. Its most striking feature is that it is terrifying. This one leaves a lasting impression on Daniel. Clearly, this is the one that he focuses on. This is the one that grabs his attention. It underscores the fact that this is different from all of the rest. And for this one, Daniel can't even figure out what it's kind of like. This is so different that he can't even figure out a kind of like for this one. It is dreadful, it's terrifying, and it's extremely strong. It has iron teeth. It is far more scary than the other three. It's also very destructive. It devours, it crushes, and it tramples. And then it says, the rest. What is the rest? Well, the rest apparently is whatever remains after he does all of his devouring and crushing. He devours and crushes, and whatever crumbs or whatever fall on the ground, then he tramples. So everything gets mashed. So it's kind of a picture of extreme and pointless destruction. In one really important way, it was different from all of the other animals, and that is it has 10 horns. And Daniel looks at that and he's wondering about these 10 horns. I mean, what kind of animal could possibly have 10 horns? And he looks at these, and as he's looking at them, there's one additional horn that shows up. It's a little horn, but it shows up. And it crowds out three others. It uproots three others. This word uprooted shows up a lot in the prophetic works. But usually it's used with respect to God uprooting a kingdom, just taking it out and destroying it. So this little horn, it uproots three of the 10. And this little horn also has some human qualities. It has eyes like a human. It also has a mouth and it talks. So it's a little bit human-like. But I think that this thing is human-like in a different sense from the first beast, which became somewhat human-like. We'll talk about what's going on there. But I think that this little horn is human-like in the sense that it is frail, mortal, but it is arrogant. It makes God-like boasts. Now, there's more of this vision before we get into the interpretation, and that's verses 9 and 10. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white as wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze, and a river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. So while this fourth beast is rampaging around, and while the small horn is boasting up a storm, there's another place where there's activity. So the scene shifts, and we start, Daniel looks to this other place where things are happening. And what he sees here is a throne room of some sort. So he sees thrones being set up. One throne is being set up for the Ancient of Days. So I think that's the eternal one. And it would appear that he is getting ready to sit in judgment. We get that from much later, but that appears to be what's happening here. So everything is being set up for the Ancient of Days to begin judging. The appearance of Ancient of Days is his clothing is white, his hair is white. So there's a purity and lightness to his appearance. everything around him is engulfed in fire. The throne has fire, the wheels of the throne have fire, and there's this river of fire that's flowing out from the throne. So there's fire all around him. And fire is an interesting symbol in the Old Testament in particular. Fire is, on the one hand, very destructive, but on the other hand, it's very purifying. So fire is able to take valuable things down to their essence. There are myriads of attendants around this throne. It's thousands and thousands, thousands upon thousands, and 10,000s upon 10,000s. I think these numbers are just there to underscore there are a lot of them there. And in the ancient world, the more attendants that a king had, the more powerful the king. So that's underscoring God's power and significance to have that many attendants. The court is seated. They're just about ready for judgment to begin. And the books were opened. I'm not sure what these books are. There are several books that are referred to in this kind of context in prophecy. One is a book of names of those who will be destroyed and those who will receive life in eternity. There's another book that seems to be the whole history of the world, and that's consulted to make sure that things are going down the way that they're supposed to go down. And there are other possible books that might be used in the throne room where the final judgment takes place. So it's not clear exactly what these books are, but they're being opened to be consulted here as the final judgment takes place. Verses 11 and 12. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and his body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. So now Daniel's attention is shifted from the throne room scene back to the scene that he had seen at the very beginning. And in particular, his attention is drawn to this little horn, this little pipsqueak horn that's making outrageous boasts. And I'll point out that it's this little horn, of all the things in this vision, this little horn gets the most attention. And we'll learn more about this horn when we look at the angel's interpretation of it. Then it says that the fourth king, the fourth beast, when this little horn is boasting most loudly, the fourth beast was killed, and with it, presumably, the little horn. And the corpse was burned in fire. It's destroyed. Verses 13 and 14. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Daniel's attention comes back to the throne room scene. And in the throne room scene, he sees this one like a son of man. Again, it's just like a son of man, but it's like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. Now, this image of a god coming with the clouds, it's very common with Baal in Canaanite mythology, that Baal comes on the clouds or with the clouds when he moves into action. So there's a common image in mythology of the ancient Near East, and it's being borrowed here. So this is a divine-like being arriving with the clouds. And it's interesting that that same imagery is used in the Old Testament. We see God coming down on Mount Sinai, and there it's enshrouded in clouds. So it's God coming on or in the clouds. An interesting observation here. This is the third man-like thing in this chapter. We have the lion that was transformed to become more man-like. We have the small horn that has certain man-like features, the worst of man-like features. And now we have this son of man who is coming with the clouds. The son of man is then presented to the Ancient of Days, and the Ancient of Days grants to him power, a kingdom, and glory. So this son of man is being made the king of this kingdom. And people from every nation, every language is a part of this kingdom. And they populate the kingdom and they serve him. And this kingdom and his authority in it lasts forever. So this is an eternal kingdom that's granted to the Son of Man. And I'll just point out that there's a sense in which this scene is less symbolic than the beginning of chapter 7. Okay, this is the end of the vision proper, but then within the vision, Daniel receives an interpretation. So the vision incorporates that as well. Verses 15 through 18. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the true meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. So Daniel, having seen this, the first part of the vision proper, he is very disturbed. He is distressed. He knows that what he's seen, he doesn't understand what he's seen, but he knows that what he's seen is bad. It looks bad. And he's alarmed. The vision has had a big impact on him. So the vision isn't soothing or reassuring at all. I think that's interesting. So Daniel, he seeks out someone to explain it to him. And it's not clear where he seeks this out and who he seeks it out from. My assumption is that it's one of these attendants in the throne room that he seeks out. I don't know. Other than that, I don't know. So it starts with a brief orientation to the symbolism of the vision. And that brief orientation is that the beasts are four kings or kingdoms, and that the saints will receive the eternal kingdom. But then that's not a very adequate interpretation. So Daniel follows up with some questions. I'm glad he did this. I wish he had followed up with more questions as we get further along, but he seems to wear out too quickly. Verses 19 through 22. Then I wanted to know the true meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws. The beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head and about the other horn that came up, before which three of them fell. The horn that looked more imposing than the others, and that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the saints and defeating them, until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. So Daniel, having received his two-phrase interpretation of the vision is not satisfied. He is particularly interested in the fourth beast, though. And so that's what he asks about. It was different from all of the others, very dreadful. It has iron teeth, and then here it adds, and bronze claws. So it's even more terrifying in this description of it. And it devoured and crushed everything. Whatever it didn't devour and crush, it trampled. So it's very destructive. Daniel is also interested in the 11th horn in particular. And that horn was the most imposing. It's the one that had eyes and a mouth and was making the boasts. And Daniel, in talking about this, adds a little bit more detail than he had had before about the horn, saying specifically that the horn fought with the saints and it was being victorious against them until the Ancient of Days acted. And the Ancient of Days did act, came to judge. The judgment was in the favor of the saints, and it was time for the saints to be given power over the kingdom, this being now the eternal kingdom. Verses 23 to 28 are then the interpretation, or the answer, I suppose, to the questions that Daniel had asked. He gave me this explanation. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The ten horns are ten kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue three kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. So the interpreter explains a little bit more fully what the fourth beast is. The fourth beast is the fourth kingdom, which will be different from all the others, and its differentness is underscored here. It will crush the whole world, and it will have 10 kings. The 11th king will rise and supplant three of those 10 kings. This horn, then, will persecute the saints. He will badmouth God, he will oppress the saints, and he will want to change the times and the laws. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Eventually, the divine court will sit in judgment. Dominion will be taken away from this fourth beast, and the fourth kingdom will be destroyed. And the power will be then handed over to the saints, which I take to be the people of God. And their reign will be eternal, and all powers will serve and obey God. Okay, the last verse of the chapter, verse 28. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself. So this is obviously very upsetting. I don't know exactly what all made it upsetting. I don't know whether it's that it was so scary or whether it's the fact that it was so confusing. It's probably a combination of both. He didn't tell anyone, which is a curious thing to both record and a curious thing for him to do. But he did write down, we know that he wrote down a summary of it from earlier. Okay, that's the chapter. Now let me put this together as best I can, and then we can talk about it. And as I say, I watched a lot of presentations on this over the summer, And there are a lot of different interpretations of it. And I will point out, everybody, when they present it, they sound convincing. But then you hear somebody else who gives a different interpretation, and that sounds convincing. So hopefully mine will sound convincing. But what I did and what I would recommend that you do is you listen to what I have to say and then just sit on it, stew on it, think about it, and see if it fits. Up to now in the book of Daniel, there have been bits and pieces that have indicated what empire is. And empire hasn't looked all that ominous. You could see hints of it being ominous, but it doesn't look all that bad because there's so much buffering that occurs that protects Daniel and his friends from the full force of empire. But now we're going to see that other side. It isn't something to take lightly. Empire is oppressive. It is inherently oppressive when it's given full development. It is hostile to God, and similarly, and as a corollary, it is hostile to the people of God. Now, I'm going to interpret this as building on the vision that we had in chapter 2. The vision in chapter 2, we had that statue that was made up of different metals. And what I argued is that in that vision, what's happening is God is revealing the trajectory of empire. And it only has two kingdoms that have any identifiable characteristic, two of the four worldly kingdoms that have any identifiable characteristics. We have the first being gold, and we're told that that's Babylon, that's Nebuchadnezzar. And then the fourth is the one that is that doesn't cohere, it doesn't stick together. And it's tough, it's harsh, it's hard. So those are the only two that have really characteristics that you can start to work with to figure out what it's referring to. The other two, it appears to me, are just kind of anonymous placeholders. So we're just seeing the trajectory. That's all it's describing. It's using a few plotted points to describe the trajectory of empire. And what it's headed toward is the last, those feet made of clay and iron. In this chapter, chapter 7, similarly, we have four beasts that represent the four earthly kingdoms. And once again, it's charting out what is empire and where is it headed, but it does it in a little bit different way. And it gives us enough detail about each beast to be able to make guesses as to what is being symbolized by those beasts. Notice that in both visions, the fourth beast is the last, but it's also the most different from the others. It stands out the most. So whatever the trajectory is, there's a sharp turn at the end that's being indicated. Now, verse 12 is important for understanding the vision, and there are two different ways that verse 12 could be taken. One would be to understand that these beasts come out one by one, but once they come out, they're all marauding about at the same time. And when the fourth beast is killed, its kingdom is destroyed immediately, completely. However, the other beasts were allowed to continue to maraud and have an existence for a while before their dominion is taken away. Not necessarily marauding, they could just be existing, but then their existence is, their dominion is terminated a little later. That's the perspective that Chris White takes. And he's got a couple of essays that are available online. I encourage you to look at those. But then he then sees the all four of these as being kingdoms that come into being at the end of history. Option two would be to see these beasts as coming in succession. That one beast comes out, marauds a while, and then it's gone. Then the second beast comes out. But that last beast, when its power is taken away, it is immediately destroyed. But verse 12 would be telling us, unlike that, the other beasts, they continued to have existence after their power was removed. They continued to have an ongoing existence after their power was removed, unlike the fourth beast, which it was destroyed as soon as its power was removed. That's the perspective that Joel Richardson takes, and there are others that take it as well, but Joel Richardson in particular. Therefore, he would understand this vision to indicate a succession of kingdoms, only the last of which is at the end of history. I lean towards the second option. It seems to me that fits better. It is common in the prophetic works for a prophet to give both a short-term prediction and a long-term prediction. And that would then fit that pattern, insofar as the second beast in particular is a short-term prediction. The third beast is also short from our perspective. It's a number of years later, but it's relatively short term. So the first, second, and third would all have been identifiable. They all would have been fulfilled within the first two or three centuries after the prediction was made. The fourth one then at the end of time. Okay. So this vision in chapter 7 is again presenting what I call the trajectory of empires, telling us where empire is going, and in particular, describing the telos, the endpoint of empire. And it's doing it by giving what I refer to in my notes as random samples. Of course, they aren't random, but it's just giving us three data points on that arch, of the trajectory. Three of those then are near term, relatively speaking, and then one is at the end of that trajectory. I see no reason why we should assume that these four kingdoms are comprehensive, that is, the only four kingdoms that existed in world history, nor that they are necessarily consecutive. That is to say, that when the first kingdom ends, that the second kingdom starts. There could be a gap of time there. There could be a gap of time between each of them. And the way I'm seeing it, there could be a whole bunch of other kingdoms interspersed in there as well. So that is someplace where my interpretation differs from what other people have presented. I'll just point out that a lot of interpreters see the fourth empire as being the Roman Empire, but all recognizing that was a long time ago. So what it has to represent is the Roman Empire and some kind of heir to that Roman Empire. So that's one way that people interpret this. Another would be to take Joel Richardson's perspective, and that is all of these are dealing with Islamic empires. But he too sees that pretty much comprehensive and pretty much consecutive. And I don't see that as necessary. And if it's not comprehensive and consecutive, unfortunately, it doesn't give us much to go on to identify the fourth beast. But it seems to me that's where we are. All right, let me retell the vision then. The vision is describing a situation in which there is this sea of humanity that is, and it's a great vision, it seems to me, it's a storm-tossed sea, it's driven by the winds. God acting through the interests and the desires and the fears and insecurities of mankind, that God, through those things, enters into the pool of humanity and what it's doing in history. And from time to time, the sea of humanity that's sloshing around, it belches out a beast. So we have, this is belching out four beasts. First one beast, and then another beast, and then another beast, and then the fourth beast. And all of them are powerful and destructive. And I think implied in that is oppressive. That the main connotation of that word destructive, I think, in these passages is oppressiveness. It's destructive towards human beings and their well-being. So one by one, these are belched out and they do their thing. The first empire, I think, is Babylon. That's what it was in chapter 2, and I think that's what it is here in chapter 7. And it's interesting that the gate of Ishtar that I mentioned before has lions on the gate. They're not just lions. There are also, it looks to me like they're bulls and also dragons of some sort, but there are lions on that iconography. And people suggest that lions, the image of a lion, was closely associated with Babylon. I don't know for sure that that's the case, but it could be. If this is Babylon, the stripping of the wings is interesting, and the making it stand on the hind feet is interesting, because we have described in Daniel, and earlier in Daniel, the story of Nebuchadnezzar and God working on Nebuchadnezzar to humble him. And God did indeed humble him. So there's a kind of humanizing that takes place in the emperor, and therefore I assume, to some degree, in the empire. So I think that that's a fitting image for Babylon. The second one seems to be the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medo-Persian Empire was an alliance of two kingdoms, the kingdom of Media and the kingdom of Persia. They came together, but the Persian Empire came to be the dominant one by far as time went on. And so that could account for the bear being lopsided. And then remember, the bear had three ribs sticking out of its mouth. Well, the Medo-Persian Empire did incorporate three large kingdoms into its empire. The empire, the kingdom of Lydia, which was most of what is Anatolia, what is now modern-day Turkey. Babylon, which was also, Lydia, by the way, was very wealthy. Babylon, which was also wealthy, and is Mesopotamia in that area, but also Egypt down in northeastern Africa. So there were three significant kingdoms that the Medo-Persian Empire incorporated. So that could be the three ribs that are being described. I don't know what it means when the bear is urged to eat its fill of flesh. I don't know whether it's saying be rapacious, be conquer a lot. I'm not sure exactly what that means. The third empire, I think, is the Macedonian Empire. The four wings would make a lot of sense on this if the wings connote speed, because Alexander the Great conquered an enormous area in an incredibly short period of time, absolutely unprecedented. In just 5 or 6 years, he conquers all of the Persian Empire and beyond, all the way to India, modern-day India. So it was an enormous achievement in an extremely short period of time. So those four wings make a lot of sense. When Alexander died, the empire was divided up among his generals. Now, if you try to answer the question into how many parts was it divided, that's a difficult question to answer, because it was so fluid. At different times, you could give a different number to that. But the number four is a is a good answer with respect to how did it settle out. It kind of settled out that it was divided into four pieces. And so the four heads make sense. And we're going to see the four show up later in Daniel. And that seems to be the number that it's associating with what remains of Alexander the Great's empire after he dies. What it means when it says it was given authority to rule, I don't know. I'm not sure what that is suggesting. Then the fourth empire, I think, is the last empire, the empire towards which history is building. Significantly, it is different from anything that Daniel could imagine. So this is unimaginable to Daniel. So he gets a glimpse of this thing. He sees this fourth beast, but he can't liken it to anything. There's nothing like it that's in his experience. It is particularly terrifying and particularly destructive. It will have 10 kingdoms, but of those 10 kingdoms, three get rooted out and replaced by one small kingdom that then rises up and becomes particularly arrogant and boastful. And it says that he's going to he tries to determine the laws and the times. I assume that what this means, when it says that he tries to determine the times or the laws, is that he thinks that he can decide what is right and what is wrong. He can decide morality, which, if that's true, that is extremely audacious. Furthermore, the times, he can determine the times. And I think that means he can determine the times, the timing of world events. I'll do this very briefly. There's a great passage in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by Solzhenitsyn. And his main character, Ivan Denisovich, is in the gulag and has been there for a long time and will be there for a long time. And he hears this rumor from the outside world that the Soviet government has changed to daylight time. They've shifted so that the society moves to daylight time, like we have, the time change. But this character, who's a peasant, kind of a poor peasant type character, he can't figure this out. I mean, how can the Soviet government change when noon is? And it's a great image. I love it, because there's an arrogance that is kind of hinted at by the change in time. Can we actually change time, if you think about it? And I think that that's what's the arrogance that's shown here as well, that this small horn thinks that it can determine when the events of history will take place, that it controls history. The other feature of this fourth empire is it persecutes and kills the people of God. But just when it looks like the people of God will be completely destroyed, God comes in judgment. So at the appointed time, when the time is just right, God is going to move to destroy that fourth kingdom. And in its place, a Messiah will be given authority over this eternal kingdom. And all people will be united in a common effort. But this time, they will be united in a common effort that will be determined by God. That God will be the one that provides the unifying purpose for the kingdom. Okay. This chapter, then, if I'm understanding it correctly, it is stressing the horror of empire, unlike chapter 2, where it stressed how fleeting empire is. This stresses the horror of empire. And I think that we are understanding it correctly if we see the horror of empire, because that was Daniel's overwhelming response. It's interesting that he could have focused on the good the goodness of this kingdom to come, the eternal kingdom. But he doesn't. He doesn't come away consoled by that. He is left disturbed by this, by what he's seen. This empire is hostile to God, and we haven't seen that really very clearly before. That was hinted at in chapter 5, but it is hostile to God. And we saw that in Belshazzar in chapter 5, but that's the only hint we saw earlier. At the end of history, it would appear God is going to allow empire to fully develop and reach its telos. It will be the ultimate manifestation of human rebellion against God. But God is going to bring that to an end just before it destroys everything. Why would God give Daniel this vision at this time? I think it's because he's getting the first glimpse of it in the person of Belshazzar, the king. Why does God present such a negative picture? Why doesn't he temper it more with more talk about the eternal kingdom, etc.? I think it's because it will be bad, and it's important for his people to know in advance that it will indeed be bad. Because in the absence of a warning of how bad it's going to be, people might lose faith. And I thought about why would God do it this way? Why would he tell us of this terrible thing that's going to happen and kind of leave us scared? Why doesn't he come in with overwhelming reassurance of the kingdom to come? In other parts of scripture and prophecy, there are wonderful depictions of the eternal kingdom and how great that is. So it's not like prophecy is devoid of that. That would be very untrue. But in this particular passage, he hasn't dwelled on that. He wants the badness of this empire to stick. And I think that happens. But how do we cope with this? I've thought about this a lot, and because looking at these prophetic works and seeing their description of what's coming, it is scary, it is disturbing. But I trust that whatever happens and whatever we as individuals have to go through, and I don't know when this will be, whether it's coming right around the corner or whether it's another generation or two off, I don't know. But things look a little ominous to me as I look out at current events. And what it always comes down to when I think about this is we have to trust that God will see us through. Whatever happens, whatever we as individuals are put through, we have to trust that God will be there with us and God will see us through it. We can't allow that to happen which gave rise to empire in the first place. That fear and insecurity run rampant in our lives and put us in a position where we'll sell our souls to the devil to deal with that fear and insecurity. We can't go that direction. We have to turn towards God and trust that he will see us through whatever happens. I had some other things that I was going to say in my conclusion, but I'm just going to skip those. If you want to see what they are, you can look at my notes that were sent out to you. There are some questions, and I'm going to take some time to respond to those. Does the number of beasts, 4, somehow signify all? I think the answer is yes. These 4 are representative of the whole complement of empires in the world. So in that sense, they represent the whole span of human history and what has happened with respect to empire. Another question, Revelation chapter 13, 1-2 seems to relate to this vision. The description seems to suggest some kind of continuity of attributes. Let me get Revelation 13, 1 and 2 out. It says, "And he stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns were 10 diadems, and on its heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and its feet were like those of a bear, and its mouth like those of a lion. And a dragon gave him his authority, and the dragon gave him his authority and his throne and great authority." Absolutely. What's interesting here is, even within Daniel, if I'm correct, that the vision in chapter 2 is related to the vision in chapter 7, notice that they're completely different visions, that it's visualized differently. There's different symbolism in the different visions, but they all kind of work together. It appears to me that in the composition of the book of Revelation, that John took pieces, not just from Daniel, but he took a lot from Daniel. He takes some pieces of imagery, and he puts them together to create his own unique image. And that's what you've got here. You've got this beast coming out of the sea. Great, that fits in perfectly with what we saw in chapter 7. But this beast looks different from any of the beasts in chapter 7. However, this beast has attributes of each of the four beasts that you see in chapter 7. So it's depicting this in Revelation, the beast that comes out of the sea has a little bit of each of these kingdoms in it. It's a conglomeration of all of these. So that's a really interesting use of the imagery in Daniel 7. And that happens a lot in Revelation. Robbie says, "The first three kingdoms you name are consecutive, and they all had power over Israel. Do you think the fourth kingdom will also have power over Israel especially?" That's true. The first three kingdoms are consecutive. They did all have control over Israel. Does the fourth? The fourth absolutely does. And that's clear from the way it's described in the book of Daniel. We haven't seen that yet. It says, it does say warring against the people of God, but what does it mean by the people of God? It says warring over the saints. I have substituted in there the people of God. And that is my way of referring to those people who are set aside by God for himself. So that's my way of describing true believers, whether they be Jews or whether they be Christians. It's just anyone who is truly devoted to the God of the Bible. And it is clear as we go into Daniel that the fourth beast, this last empire, comes to bear on the land of Israel specifically. And that's one of the things that happens in the last half. The last half of Daniel is now going to focus on what does this mean for, in particular, the land and the people of Israel? And that's what it will develop. Rusty asks, "Is empire by definition evil? In other words, is empire necessarily at odds with God? Is the kingdom of God not empire because it seeks God rather than try to replace him?" The way I am using the word empire, it is by definition evil. Because part of my definition is that people come together and united towards a common goal, that is providing for the security and well-being of this community. And this community then becomes that thing to which we all owe our primary allegiance. So it steps into human existence and requires exclusive worship from everyone. That is inherently evil. But as Jacques Ellul points out in The Meaning of the City, I've mentioned that before, and I'll probably mention it again, but what Jacques Ellul points out, and he's talking about city, the concept of city is developed throughout the Bible. And he argues that it is a pool of wickedness. But at the end of time, does God destroy city so that it is never seen again? It never exists again? And the answer is no. What exists after judgment, what is going to be at the center of human life, is going to be a city. It's going to be a redeemed city. God is going to take the ugliness that city represents, strip that all away, and fill it with righteousness, and that becomes the new city, the city in eternity. Similarly, the way I'm using the word empire, in eternity, God strips empire of all of its ugliness, all of its wickedness, and infuses righteousness right into the middle of it, and then that is what goes on in eternity. I think that's fascinating. Thank you for going through this with me. It's odd doing this in this format in some respects, but thank you for doing this with me, and I hope this is helpful, and we'll go on to chapter 8 next week, another vision, and we'll do it much like we've done this one. Thank you for your attention. See you next week. Bye.